KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
There's a concern of what the loss of those federal oversights could mean in the long run to our students with disabilities.
The Trump administration is threatening to dismantle the Department of Education. What would that mean for children with disabilities?
For Friday, March 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. How widespread layoffs in the federal government could impact the picture of the U.S. job market.
So this is really the tip of the iceberg, this loss of 10,000 federal jobs, many more to come. It seems like that is an unfortunate reality we'll be looking at in coming months.
Also, it's been 60 years since law enforcement officers attacked marchers in Selma, Alabama.
What took place on that bridge literally changed the face of American politics.
And Florida leads the way in helping the federal government crack down on immigration.
Those stories after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Even as he's paused planned 25% tariffs against Mexico and Canada, President Trump is railing against what he's called tremendously high Canadian tariffs on dairy and lumber products coming into the country from the U.S. Speaking in the Oval Office today, he said he plans to potentially retaliate.
Canada has been ripping us off for years on tariffs for lumber and for dairy products. 250%, nobody ever talks about that, 250% tariff, which is taking advantage of our farmers, so that's not going to happen anymore.
The president's latest remarks add to the trade pressure against the Canadian government, which Trump has accused of failing to stop the flow of the deadly drug fentanyl across the northern border. That's despite little evidence such trafficking is actually taking place. An attorney appointed by a federal judge in Manhattan says all corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams should be dropped permanently. Comes after the Justice Department sought to put the criminal case on hold. Here's NPR's Brian Mann.
Adams was charged last year with bribery and corruption. He denies any wrongdoing. Under President Trump's leadership, the DOJ moved to shelve the case, a controversial move that led to the resignation of top U.S. attorneys. Critics say the deal would allow the White House to threaten New York City's mayor with renewed prosecution if Adams doesn't help round up migrants who lack legal status. The judge asked attorney Paul Clement to write a legal brief examining the case. Clement now says the charges should be tossed out for good to avoid, quote, the appearance, if not the reality, that the Trump administration might use the threat of prosecution to pressure an elected official. Judge Dale Ho has promised a swift ruling. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
The Trump administration says it's ending collective bargaining for thousands of workers at the Transportation Security Administration. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
The Department of Homeland Security says it's eliminating the collective bargaining agreement for 47,000 TSA officers who are responsible for protecting the U.S. aviation system. In a statement, DHS said that agreement was hindering the TSA's mission of keeping Americans safe and accused the TSA's union of protecting poor performers and devoting too many hours to union work. In response, the union called DHS's claims completely fabricated and promised to push back on what it called an unprovoked attack. The Biden administration reached a deal last year with the TSA union to expand workers' rights and raise pay, which top Democrats say has helped to lower the agency's high attrition rate. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has signed an executive order aimed at a program that forgives student loans for people in public service careers. Critics say the order appears aimed at targeting organizations that work on causes the administration does not approve of. Public service loan forgiveness program is for government or nonprofit employees, including teachers and public health workers who've made 10 years of loan payments, allowing for the remainder of their debt to be wiped out. Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today, the Dow up 222 points. This is NPR. Democrats apparently frustrated that their strategy of pointing out authoritarian actions by the Trump administration is not gaining more traction with many Americans, say they intend to turn their focus to high prices. That includes still high prices for eggs brought on by the bird flu and other price pressures being faced by voters. The increased attention by Democrats on pocketbook issues like the cost of groceries comes as the party's determined it needs to make changes to win back the hearts and minds of working class voters, many of whom voted for Trump last fall. Actor Gene Hackman and his wife, Betsy Arakawa, have likely died of natural causes several days apart in their home in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Alice Fordham of member station KUNM has more.
Chief Medical Examiner Heather Jarrell performed an autopsy on Arakawa and found she died of hantavirus, while Hackman died of heart disease and Alzheimer's. Hantavirus is contracted from rodents and has a mortality rate in the Southwest of up to 50%. Santa Fe County Sheriff Adan Mendoza said that Arakawa was last seen on February 11th on surveillance cameras running errands. Jarrell said likely Arakawa died first. Based on pacemaker activity, Hackman probably died around February 18th. She added that due to his advanced Alzheimer's, it's possible he was not aware that his wife was deceased. The sheriff said the investigation would remain open pending obtaining cell phone data and a necropsy of a dog also found dead. For NPR News, I'm Alice Fordham in Santa Fe.
This weekend is that once-a-year event known as Daylight Saving Time. The main benefit is extra sunlight during the evening hours. There's still lots of debate on the topic, though. About 70 countries currently use daylight saving time. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Parents of kids with disabilities are used to fighting. Fighting for understanding, for acceptance, and for resources. And that is why so many of them fear the possible elimination of the Department of Education. That's the federal agency that distributes federal funds meant to help educate kids with disabilities. Now, to be clear, eliminating the Department of Education does not mean the funding will go away entirely. Still, many parents are very concerned. And one of those parents is Christy Hedler. Her son, Kellen, has Down syndrome and receives special education services at school. Christy is also a parent services advocate at the nonprofit Oklahoma Parents for Student Achievement. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So as this country is preparing for what could be major changes to the Department of Education, what are you personally watching for? What are you most worried about when it comes to the rights of students with disabilities?
My biggest concern is the fear of the unknown. We currently have a system that, you know, IDEA still is not fully funded.
IDEA, that's the federal law that helps ensure that children with disabilities get the resources they need in public education, correct?
Yes. With that still not being funded, you know, we have had to consistently fight to make sure that our children with disabilities are receiving the services and supports that they're legally entitled to. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest concerns with the Department of Education potentially being dismantled is what is going to happen when that federal oversight is removed and that power is given to the states. And so I'm concerned that some states will really prioritize making sure that these students continue receiving a quality education, while others will focus more on cutting the budget for those students, and that we will end up in a segregated educational system.
A segregated educational system with possible inequities.
Yes.
Say more about that, because to be clear, the new education secretary, Linda McMahon, she has said that this law is going to stay in place, but perhaps the task of implementing it could move to another federal department, perhaps the Department of Health and Human Services. Do you have concerns about the implementation of this law moving to another federal agency?
Yes, I do. My concerns with it moving to a different federal agency is potentially the lack of preparedness for that kind of a move. The Department of Health and Human Services, you know, I'm uncertain if they are capable to monitor and enforce special education policies and laws. and what happens to the enforcement arms that are currently in place at the Department of Education that provide oversight.
Yeah. I mean, some people may not realize the Department of Education also has an Office for Civil Rights that oversees discrimination complaints from students with disabilities. I'm just curious, is that a service that you have ever personally had to rely on, either for your child or for parents that you advocate for?
Yes, we utilize the Office of Civil Rights when we find that complaints on a state level are not producing the types of outcomes that we really need them to. And it's a very real concern. How are schools and how are these states going to now be accountable for these types of violations? How are they going to be processed? It's concerning to me that losing the Office of Civil Rights could weaken the protections and increase discrimination and inequity for our children with disabilities.
When it comes to individual states playing more of a significant role in education, I mean, Secretary McMahon has already said the Department of Education would, quote, send education back to the states. And I know that you've told us that you and your family would consider leaving Oklahoma, depending on the kinds of changes that come from the federal government. Can you explain why you would leave Oklahoma?
There are a lot of states like Oklahoma that I don't feel place the same importance on educating students with disabilities, that they don't see that these are children who are entitled to and deserve an education. And I think Oklahoma is one of those. And that's absolutely something that my family has talked about, is where do we need to go to make sure that Kellen gets the education that he has a legal right to?
Christy Hedler. She's also a parent services advocate at the nonprofit Oklahoma Parents for Student Achievement. Thank you very much for joining us today, Christy.
Thank you so much for having me.
The U.S. job market is holding steady for now. Today we learned that employers added more than 150,000 jobs in February. That is slightly more than the previous month. With widespread layoffs in the federal government, however, today's report offers a somewhat incomplete picture. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Juana.
So, Scott, help me out here. There are some sort of mixed messages in today's jobs report. What is it telling us?
Yeah, it depends where you look. You know, President Trump highlighted the monthly uptick in manufacturing jobs. Factories added about 10,000 jobs last month, which is certainly encouraging. But the report also shows 10,000 jobs were lost last month in the federal government. And Elise Gould, who's with the Economic Policy Institute, says that's just the beginning as this administration aims for a much sharper downsizing of the federal workforce.
So this is really the tip of the iceberg, this loss of 10,000 federal jobs, many more to come. It seems like that is an unfortunate reality we'll be looking at in coming months.
You know, the jobs report's always based on a survey that's conducted in the middle of the month, and most of the federal layoffs happened after that. We'll start to see those cuts more fully reflected in the next few months. Meanwhile, healthcare continues to add jobs month after month, and construction jobs rebounded in February after a very cold and snowy January.
What is happening to private sector hiring overall as we're watching the federal government really scale back?
You know, overall hiring last month was down a little bit from the average over the last 12 months. Restaurants and bars cut about 27,000 jobs in February. Temporary help services cut back as well. Business surveys that came out this week suggest a lot of employers are in a wait-and-see mode 6+ weeks into the Trump administration. You know, so far it's been a roller coaster ride. Just think about this week with tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico. They were off, then they were on, then they were mostly off again, but Trump says they could be back on in another month. Gould says for would-be employers, that's a tricky environment.
I think that makes it very hard for business owners to know about hiring or not. Maybe they won't hire because of that economic uncertainty, and they're going to hold off. And that could also lead to some stagnation in our growth.
Would-be workers are also wrestling with uncertainty. We saw about 385,000 people drop out of the workforce last month. Some of those were foreign-born workers, which could be a reflection of stepped-up immigration enforcement. Meanwhile, the unemployment rate inched up to 4.1%.
Scott, how are tariffs, or even really the threat of tariffs, affecting the broader economy?
It's just too early to tell. Tariffs that took effect at the beginning of February on imports from China are still in effect, and in fact those were increased this week, and Trump is threatening a lot more tariffs in the weeks to come. If he follows through on that, most economists think it will raise prices here in the U.S. The Federal Reserve is watching that as it tries to decide what to do about interest rates. But Fed Chairman Jerome Powell said today he and his colleagues are also watching the administration's other moves on immigration and regulation and taxes and spending.
While there have been recent developments in some of these areas, especially trade policy, uncertainty around the changes and their likely effects remains high. We do not need to be in a hurry, and we are well positioned to wait for greater clarity.
And today's fairly solid jobs report gives the Federal Reserve the luxury to take its time and see how this all plays out.
Well, I guess we're going to have to wait and see, too. That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Dolly Parton's husband, Carl Dean, died this week. This morning, she released a new song, which, like some of her biggest hits, was inspired by him.
Without you, trust, love, and believe.
If You Hadn't Been There is Parton's ode to Dean and their 6 decades of marriage, as NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
Dolly Parton moved to Nashville when she was 18 years old. Her first day there, she went to the wishy-washy laundromat.
I'd brought some dingy, dirty little clothes from home, and so I was just down there doing my laundry and walking around on the sidewalk.
That's Parton speaking to NPR in 2014.
Carl Dean came riding by, and he pulled over and said something to me, and I said something to him, and 50 years later, we're still talking.
Dean and Parton were together for 60 years. Dean owned an asphalt business in Nashville, and he was known for staying out of the spotlight. So much so that there was a rumor that Parton made him up. But he was real, and he inspired this massive hit from 1973.
Jolene, 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 Jolene.
In 2008, Parton told NPR that the song was about a bank teller who paid Dean a little too much attention.
She got this terrible crush on my husband, and he just loved going to the bank because she paid him so much attention. It was kind of like a running joke between us when I was saying, hell, you're spending a lot of time at the bank. I don't believe we've got that kind of money. So it's really an innocent song all around, but sounds like a dreadful one.
I'm begging of you, please don't take my man.
Parton told the press that Dean was not the biggest fan of country music. He was more of a hard rock guy. But he stood by the side of one of country's most enduring voices until his death on Monday. Parton wrote this song in his memory.
If you hadn't been you, well, who would I be?
Parton released If You Hadn't Been There at midnight. On her Instagram, she wrote, quote, he will always be the star of my life story, and I dedicate this song to him. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
I wouldn't be here if you hadn't been there holding my hand.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. An event on this day in 1965 helped spark the passage of the Voting Rights Act. It was the thick of the civil rights movement. Protesters in Selma, Alabama planned to march to Montgomery to demand the right to vote for black people who were regularly turned away when they tried to register. The state's brutal response to the protest shocked the nation into action. Now, as people gather in Selma this week to remember that time, NPR's Debbie Elliott has this look at the history and what lies ahead.
I'm here watching the traffic cross over Selma's iconic Edmund Pettus Bridge. This is the site where 60 years ago, state troopers and sheriff's deputies attacked voting rights marchers in an incident known as Bloody Sunday.
And we got to the highest point on this bridge. Down below, we saw a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers.
That's the late Georgia Congressman John Lewis describing what happened in an interview with NPR on the bridge 10 years ago. He was one of the leaders of what was supposed to be a march from Selma to Montgomery, motivated by the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson, a black man shot by a state trooper during a civil rights demonstration in a nearby town. But then Alabama Governor George Wallace, the staunch segregationist, sent state troopers ahead to halt the march.
You are ordered to disperse, go home, or go to your church. This march will not continue. Is that clear to you?
The peaceful marchers refused to turn back. They kneeled and prayed. Then troopers and sheriff's deputies, some on horseback, attacked, beating people with batons and launching tear gas canisters. Lewis's head was cracked open. Local activist Amelia Boynton Robinson was bludgeoned. News coverage of the violence that day reverberated around the world, shedding new light on how far Alabama authorities would go to protect white supremacy. President Lyndon Johnson gave this speech a week later, calling Selma a turning point in American history and urging passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
Really, it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
Alabama Democrat Terry Sewell grew up in Selma and now represents the city in Congress.
What took place on that bridge literally changed the face of American politics.
Her mother, for instance, became the first black city councilwoman in Selma. It's not lost on Sewell that her career is built on the sacrifice of those who fought 60 years ago.
I know that I get to walk the halls of Congress as Alabama's first black congresswoman because, you know, so many of those foot soldiers couldn't.
But early on, civil rights leaders did not consider Selma ripe for the movement.
They had an X through Selma. Yeah. So he said, we're not going to Selma.
That's Bernard Lafayette, now 84 years old, who was part of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Can't accomplish anything there in Selma. I say, well, why? He said that the white folks were too mean and black folks were too scared.
Sheriff's deputies would rough up black residents who tried to register to vote. People would get fired for attending mass meetings. Lafayette himself was attacked. But he was undeterred and led a voter registration project in Selma because he knew it could have a permanent impact by giving black people a say in their government.
It wasn't just being able to eat at a lunch counter or ride the bus, but it's dealing with the whole problem of segregation and discrimination and exploitation. And I didn't know how long it was going to take. But I had devoted myself, okay, that I want to be here in Selma.
Andy's been active here ever since. This week, he's been leading nonviolent workshops through the Selma Center for Nonviolence, Truth, and Reconciliation, an organization he co-founded 10 years ago. Ayinka Sanders Jackson is the center's director.
Our charge is Selma 2.0.
She says they're working on the unfinished business of bridging divides through community dialogues, economic initiatives, and violence intervention.
We believe that broken relationships have led to a broken economy, leading to broken communities, all in need of healing. Not in need of fixing, but in need of healing.
The center is located on a bluff above the Alabama River, the channel where enslaved Africans were ferried to Selma. Sanders Jackson steps outside to a deck where you can see the Edmund Pettus Bridge in the distance.
We get to do this work every day from this place and look out and see that bridge and be reminded of what our ancestors, our foremothers and forefathers sacrificed so that we can continue to plant seed and water.
She says a major focus has been economic development for Selma, a town where more than one in four people lives in poverty.
Whenever there is progress, there's always pushback, which is why Selma is where it is, because we've helped to make so much progress. There's always great pushback.
Congresswoman Terry Sewell says economic empowerment for Selma is part of the continuum of the fight for equal rights.
This progress is fragile, and every generation has to fight for it or we lose it.
Her fight is trying to restore full protections of the Voting Rights Act, some of which the U.S. Supreme Court struck down in 2013. This week, Sewell introduced the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, named for her mentor.
We've seen an erosion of our voting rights, of our civil rights. I mean, we're witnessing a serious, you know, whitewashing of history as this administration has taken aim at diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Her inspiration? The Bloody Sunday marchers. Even though beaten back on Selma's Edmund Pettus Bridge, they came back and eventually completed their 54-mile march to Montgomery, the state capital, and won equal voting rights for the nation. Bernard Lafayette says ultimately, nonviolence prevailed over violence, a lesson relevant today.
Even though you are afraid, that cannot be a barrier to working for social change.
Lafayette says in his workshops, one of the ways he helps people to overcome fear and work together is by teaching freedom songs.
Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are a-coming, oh yes. Buses are a-coming.
On Sunday, Lafayette plans to be there as a new generation of freedom fighters symbolically crosses the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Better get you ready.
Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Selma, Alabama.
That story was produced by NPR's Marisa Peñalosa.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Singer-songwriter Jason Isbell has been making music alongside his band and other musicians for most of his career, but on his new solo album, the artist set some strict rules.
I wanted to walk into a studio in the village with a single guitar and a notebook and come out of there with an album.
I'm Scott Detrow. We talked music, life, and politics with Jason Isbell on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Everything feels like it's getting more expensive.
But prices from a couple American pizza mega chains have stayed roughly the same for decades.
There was a huge coupon last month at Domino's where you could get a large one-topping pizza for $7.99.
We talk pizza and inflation after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump hosted the first ever crypto summit at the White House this afternoon, where he pushed for the creation of a Bitcoin reserve. Trump says most of its assets have already been collected from criminal and civil court proceedings. President Trump claims the government has been losing money by selling it.
The federal government is already among the largest holders of Bitcoin, as you know. Really one of the largest holders in the world, with as many as 200,000 Bitcoin obtained via civil law and various other forms of law, and including enforcement actions. These existing holdings will form the foundation of the new reserve.
Trump says creating a strategic Bitcoin reserve will allow the digital currency to grow in value the same way that the U.S. has reserves of gold. Trump himself has personal investments in cryptocurrency and has drawn criticism of conflicts of interest. His administration is cutting roughly $400 million in federal funding for Columbia University, citing claims of anti-Semitism on campus. NPR's Janet Ujung Lee reports.
The administration announced the cancellation of federal contracts and grants, citing the school's, quote, continued inaction in the face of persistent harassment of Jewish students. Columbia University is one of the 10 schools that's under investigation following President Trump's executive order on additional measures to combat anti-Semitism. Columbia University spokesperson Samantha Slater responded in a statement saying, quote, we are reviewing the announcement from the federal agency and pledge to work with the federal government to restore Columbia's federal funding. The announcement also notes that this is the first action of more cancellations to come. Janet Ujung Lee, NPR News.
Stocks finished on a high note after a brutal trading week on Wall Street. This is NPR. In Utah, pride flags, a symbol of acceptance and support for the LGBTQ plus community, could soon be banned from public schools and government property. Sage Miller of member station KUER has the story.
The bill bars most flags from being displayed in classrooms and government buildings, with some exception including the U.S. flag and the state flag. It passed both chambers of the Utah legislature, where several Republicans broke with their party to vote with Democrats against the measure. Supporters say the legislation is meant to encourage political neutrality, but critics say it's an unconstitutional attack on free speech. It's unclear what the policy would mean for Salt Lake City's annual Pride Festival that takes place on government property. Lawmakers say pride flags are allowed as long as they're not hung on government buildings, but the bill language doesn't make that clear. For NPR News, I'm Sage Miller in Salt Lake City.
A South Carolina man became the first prisoner to be executed by firing squad today in almost 20 years. Death row inmate Brad Sigmund was sentenced for the 2001 murder of his ex-girlfriend's parents. He chose the firing squad because he considered it a better option than the electric chair or lethal injection. The 67-year-old was wearing a target with a red bullseye on it and shot by three volunteer prison workers. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump announced a new tariffs threat mid-press conference today, including 250% on Canadian dairy products to roughly match Canada's tax on U.S. dairy products. The timing was a little fuzzy.
We may do it as early as today, or we'll wait till Monday or Tuesday.
This is separate from the on-again, off-again 25% tariff on all imports from Mexico and Canada. Those clicked into place on Tuesday, but were paused for many goods on Thursday, but maybe only until April 2nd. Now, businesses, they generally like predictability. Trump's tariffs have been anything but. So what does that mean for the economy? I asked Nick Bloom, an economist at Stanford University, who's the co-creator of the Economic Policy Uncertainty Index.
It is going to slow down growth, because if you're a firm out there, you're thinking of opening a new store or investing in new equipment or maybe launching an R&D project. And if you're uncertain what's going to happen, is the tariff going to come on or off? Is taxes going to go down or not? You know, is this government agency going to be able to buy your products? You may wait because it's expensive to get make a mistake. And so you think, oh, you know, let's wait a month, let's wait a couple of months, maybe 6 months and see what happens. And of course, if tens of thousands of businesses put plans on hold, that means they're not hiring and they're not investing.
And I would imagine similarly then for consumers, say I want to buy a new house, I want to buy a new car, even a new computer, similar effect. You're maybe going to sit and wait it out, right?
Yeah, exactly. You see a big slowdown in spending on what we call durables. So things like houses, cars, TVs, fridges, washing machines. All of this stuff, consumers tend to pause when uncertainty is high. And we've seen it many, many times in history. Actually, even back in the Great Depression of the 1930s, consumer durable expenditure crashed. It fell by about a half. And that is a natural reaction to high uncertainty.
Robert Rubin, who was the U.S. Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton, said that this is the moment of greatest uncertainty that he'd seen in his six-decade career. So I want to ask you, Nick Bloom, how does that square with your measurement of uncertainty? Similar?
It's very high on a, you know, 1 to 10 scale. I'll give it a 9. We've been tracking this. We have data going back almost 100 years. And you see that where we are now is pretty unprecedented. Look, it was higher with COVID. It was a little bit higher, the financial crisis. But apart from that, the levels of uncertainty now, you've got to go back kind of 50 years. What is really striking is usually politicians like to, you know, have this air of stability and calm and statesmanship, et cetera. And they generally don't want to portray uncertainty. And in the case now with Trump, he's actually generating, you know, it's obviously controversial, but it's also generating a lot of uncertainty. So what is completely unprecedented is seeing this as a deliberate policy move from a government. It's not just in the US, actually, but internationally, politicians don't like to generate uncertainty because it tends to reduce growth. So that's what's so unusual about this situation.
I mean, you and I have been talking about tariff policy, but I'm curious, is it just that, or are there other areas with sort of big blaring question marks that could be worrying for businesses?
Yeah, it's not just tariffs, it's regulation, it's taxes, it's government expenditure. I mean, imagine you're a firm out there and the government, some government agencies want to, you know, think of the Park Service, for example, as a big customer of you. And now you're like, well, what's going to happen? Are they going to lay off 30% of their staff? Like USAID, are they going to be, you know, their budget slashed or abolished? So that permeates and ripples out through the economy. And so, yes, tariffs are in some sense the most obvious right now, but it's kind of right across the range of regulations, taxes, spending that the government controls.
Back when he was candidate Trump, he promised tax cuts and less regulation. And we know that those are things that business owners usually see as good for them. And surveys showed a whole lot of optimism from executives about the economy under a Trump presidency. So let me ask you this. Does the good still outweigh the bad from the business's point of view?
It's really interesting. Trump, too, is unlike anything we've ever seen before. So we have a monthly survey of around 1,000 businesses. And they are generally pretty optimistic. They, you know, particularly after he won the election, business optimism picked up. The stock market, as you saw, jumped up. But they don't like uncertainty, and neither does the stock market. And these kind of two forces are battling against each other. Which will win out is very unclear. Certainly in the news, we're seeing increasing reports and concerns about recession coming. You know, that may or may not happen, but that wasn't really something that was discussed 3 months ago. So certainly risks are up.
That's Nick Bloom of Stanford University. Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much.
The Chicago house music scene is mourning the loss of an iconic figure. Charles Chambers, known as DJ Funk, died of cancer this week. He was 54. Jonas Adams, who's a producer at All Things Considered, is also a DJ from Chicago. He grew up in the 90s and says back then, DJ Funk's music was the soundtrack to pretty much every party.
There was nobody who could really afford a DJ like that where I was from. So what you had was mixtapes and mix CDs, and the main mix CD or mixtape that you would hear at everybody's house parties was DJ Funk. It's dark in there. It's probably in somebody's basement. It's so hot, you could barely breathe. The walls are sweating, and everybody is just dancing nonstop to these up-tempo, high-energy, ghetto house mixes.
Ghetto house is basically like underground basement, grunge, synth heavy.
That's Rob Nichols, known as DJ Scrap Dirty. He says DJ Funk pioneered ghetto house music and that it's a style of house that is unique to Chicago. The music's faster, the lyrics are edgier, it's liberating. He says when you hear it, you can't help but move your body.
Hold up. Hold up.
Ghetto house was the child that no one thought that was going to come from up under the underground. It's basically an underground sound of all the neighborhoods in Chicago.
The Chicago rave scene and house music was still in its early days when DJ Scrap Dirty first met DJ Funk.
Y'all know him as DJ Funk. We knew him as Chuck Funk.
DJ Scrap Dirty was about 14 then, just starting his career in music. He says ghetto house was ahead of its time, and he never thought it would get so popular.
When I first heard that Daft Punk tune called Teachers, the first thing I said was, Chuck is out of here. And lo and behold, you start seeing a whole bunch of international flyers. He was traveling the world. And I think that really helped him go to the next level.
In their debut album, the French duo Daft Punk have a song called Teachers that lists all the DJs who inspired their sound. Many of them are DJs from Chicago, with DJ Funk being the first one mentioned. DJ Scrap Dirty said this is the legacy of Ghetto House and what DJ Funk did alongside others in the scene.
His music will live on. His music will live through all of us, day to day, city by city, country by country. And Chicago house music been going on this long. And like they used to say on the radio, Chicago is the house music capital of the world. It will always be that, and it will always live on. DJ Chuck Funk, aka DJ Funk, will always be with us to the test of time.
In 2015, when DJ Funk was interviewed by The Guardian, he said that he didn't want a funeral. He said instead he wanted a party so people could dance, and an after party with his music playing and a lot of booty shaking. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A Hong Kong company that operates ports on both ends of the Panama Canal said this week that it had agreed to sell its business there. CK Hutchison announced it had a deal with a group of investors led by a U.S. company. The sale looks like a win for President Trump, who has repeatedly stated that he wants the U.S. to reclaim control of the Panama Canal. Reporter Charisse Pham has more from Northwest Hong Kong.
I'm here at CK Hutchison's Logistics Center in Kwai Ting Container Port, one of the busiest container ports in the world. I see miles and miles of goods and shipping containers and trucks. Everything is stacked like Lego pieces, ready to be boarded on a ship and transported around the world.
But this week, the company announced that it's selling the bulk of its ports business to a group of buyers led by BlackRock. Among the assets being sold, two ports operated by CK Hutchison in the Panama Canal that had come under fire by the Trump administration.
To further enhance our national security,
My administration will be reclaiming the Panama Canal, and we've already started doing it.
That was President Trump on Tuesday. He earlier accused China of operating the Panama Canal, an unfounded claim. Beijing called it, quote, pure lies. C.K. Hutchison maintains its operations are strictly commercial. The company traces its roots back to when Hong Kong was under British rule. It was founded by billionaire Li Ka-shing, who's now 96 years old. C.K. Hutchison is a sprawling international conglomerate, operating everything from retail shops to telecommunications.
Life needs a big network. Three.
The company had operated ports for decades, but it was an opportune time to exit a business that had come under geopolitical pressure, according to Dan Baker, senior analyst with Morningstar, a U.S. financial services company.
My view is if you get a really good price for it, why not?
Morningstar estimates Hutchison's ports business was worth about $10 billion. The company sold it to the BlackRock Group for nearly double that.
Given there has been, as of just recently, some geopolitical concerns with some of those businesses, particularly the ones in Panama, they're probably worth more in the buyer's hands than they are in Hutch's hands.
But George Chen, Hong Kong managing director of the DC consulting firm The Asia Group, argues that C.K. Hutchison's decision to sell the ports business in Panama is a blow to Hong Kong's reputation as an independent financial center.
On one hand, I think it shows, you know, Li Ka-shing, you know, he's a businessman, and he treats this more as a business decision. But on the other hand, I don't think the deal really makes Hong Kong looks good.
Chen says C.K. Hutchison striking this deal so quickly indicates Hong Kong companies nowadays really can't afford to get caught up in geopolitical storms. In a statement, a C.K. Hutchison spokesperson says the deal is, quote, purely commercial in nature and wholly unrelated to recent political news reports concerning the Panama ports.
C.K. Hutchison enters the dawn of a new season, building on a firm foundation of its past.
Hong Kong companies like C.K. Hutchison once had the best of both worlds, operating in a freer financial system separate from communist China, while still having easy access to China's vast markets. But after Beijing imposed a national security law on Hong Kong in 2020, the region has increasingly been lumped together with mainland China. Even this deal, analysts say, appears to reflect that lack of distinction. C.K. Hutchison is now selling dozens of ports in more than 20 countries, but it isn't exiting the business entirely. It will continue to own and operate ports in just two territories, Hong Kong and mainland China. For NPR News, I'm Charisse Pham in Hong Kong.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers.
There's a classic scene in the movie Home Alone where the child left alone at home orders a pizza for delivery.
How much do I owe you?
That'll be $11.80, sir.
He handles the transaction by playing clips from a mobster movie he's got queued up on the VCR.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
And once he gets the delivery guy to flee, young Kevin McAllister, well, he's living the dream.
A lovely cheese pizza just for me.
Now, for some of you, that'll be a bit of nostalgia back to the year 1990. For journalist Mark Dent, his reaction was that somehow, 35 years later, $11.80 still sounds like a reasonable price for a pizza from an American mega chain. He's investigated in a story headlined, "Is Domino's Pizza Inflation Proof?" Mark Dent, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Juana.
For starters, I'll just note that your story specifically looks up Domino's and Pizza Hut prices. How did today's prices compare to those 20 or 30 years ago?
Believe it or not, Domino's and Pizza Hut, at least, the pizza prices are almost exactly the same. The menu price for like a Domino's large pepperoni, it's something like $16 these days, and that's also true at Pizza Hut. If you go back to the late 90s and early 2000s, they're around between $13 to $14. So you're talking an increase of maybe 20% when inflation has gone up something like 90% or so since then. And I found coupons from 1999 at Domino's offering a $6.99 large one-topping pizza. There was a huge coupon last month at Domino's where you could get a large one-topping pizza for $7.99.
Interesting. So I'm curious. I mean, we're talking about these two kind of big household name chains, but what about when we talk about, I don't know, my independent local pizzeria or even just like other fast food options?
The Pizza Hut and Domino's lack of inflation is basically unique. Where I live in Dallas, there's this local chain called Campisi's where you get, it's about $25 for a large Supreme pizza. If you go back 20 years ago, it was something like 15. So it's pretty close to inflation there. And that's the same with like Taco Bell and McDonald's. Big Mac value meals are about $11 now. They were closer to $5 in the 90s. So it's really just these pizza chains that are avoiding inflation.
In your research, you found that volume is a major factor in why prices stayed relatively low. Explain what you found.
So the labor required to make one pizza was basically the same as it was to make five. So there was only ingredient cost on these extra pizzas. The margin just goes way up with the more pizza that you make. And Domino's has just perfected this. Now they sell about 20% of all pizza that's consumed in the U.S. And Americans are eating roughly twice as much pizza these years as they did in like the late 80s, for instance. And it has allowed them to keep prices low because they play the volume game so well.
Now, there's another modern affliction that we've heard a lot about in recent years, and that's hidden fees. And those are also higher now than they were in the 90s, right?
Absolutely. Starting in the early 2000s, that's when Papa John's, Pizza Hut, and Domino's, they started charging between 50 cents and a dollar for delivery fees. Now, if you order from Domino's or Pizza Hut, it's $5.
I kind of wonder, did the free market have a hand here? I mean, we just have a whole lot more pizza options than we did back then, as well as, I mean, other fast food options. Is it the fact that just increased competition helped keep prices low?
I think that's a huge part of it. When you go back, you know, 25, 30 years ago, I grew up in the Midwest in Kansas City. Like, our options were Pizza Hut, Domino's, or like Little Caesars, maybe. But now, like there in Kansas City, there's all kinds of local places that are higher quality pizza. And the only way for Domino's and Pizza Hut to compete with them and then against each other is by having lower prices. They just keep trying to go lower and lower.
That's Mark Dent of The Hustle. Mark, thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Several states are stepping up to help the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to deport immigrants who are here illegally. Enforcing immigration is a federal responsibility, but state and local law enforcement are being asked to support that work under an existing program that's been given new life by the Trump administration. As NPR's Greg Allen reports, Florida is leading the way by requiring local officials and law enforcement to cooperate with ICE or lose their jobs.
Florida recently passed new measures aimed at combating illegal immigration, including one that Governor Ron DeSantis says that's aimed directly at local law enforcement statewide.
All state and local law enforcement have a duty to participate to the fullest extent possible with federal immigration enforcement efforts.
It's called the 287G program, named for the federal statute under which it was set up in 1996. DeSantis says help from the states and local law enforcement departments is vital if Trump hopes to make good on his pledge for mass deportations of people here without legal status. At a recent Florida cabinet meeting, he said that's why he insisted all local officials would have to participate in the program or face the consequences.
I, as the governor, have a power to remove those local officials from office, as well as administer fines. And so it has teeth, and that's what you need. You need to have teeth.
A number of other states are taking steps to coordinate with ICE on deportations, but none have gone as far as Florida. Sheriffs in all of Florida's 67 counties have already signed agreements with ICE. Bob Galtieri, the sheriff in Florida's Pinellas County, calls it a big deal.
Because it means criminals like these will be deported directly from jail and not released back to the street.
For law enforcement agencies in Florida and other states ready to begin working with ICE, the holdup now is training, which is slow to get started. In the past, it took about a month of training for local cops to be certified to conduct investigations and to serve warrants to people charged with immigration violations. Galtieri says federal authorities have told him they're speeding up that process.
The training now is probably going to be able to get done within a matter of about 5 days. And be able to get law enforcement officers across Florida and across the country trained in a more reasonable amount of time so they can go out and do this.
The Trump administration is reviving parts of the 287G program that have been dormant since 2012 because of legal issues and allegations of racial profiling. Amin Kaku, a lawyer with the ACLU, represented a Florida immigrant in the country legally who was wrongfully detained under the program. He reached a settlement last year with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. Kaku worries that ICE now is rushing training and lowering the standards for local officers.
With very little regard for the well-known risks of racial profiling that are associated with this program, and we're very concerned that this will increase the number of pretextual stops and false arrests.
All law enforcement agencies in Florida now have to cooperate with ICE, but it's up to them to decide how much they want to do. Some counties are gently pushing back.
Everyone calm down and take a deep breath. We've been doing that for years.
That's Gregory Tony, the sheriff in Broward County. He says despite all the noise, the new Florida law hasn't changed much about how his department will operate. At a recent county commission meeting, he said the department has long had officers certified to work on a part of the program now being revived by ICE, street-level immigration task forces. But he says he's committed no additional resources to immigration enforcement.
I didn't sign up to be ICE. My patch doesn't say ICE. My patch says Broward County. I'm a constitutional officer. I work for the 2 million people in this county.
Tony and other Florida sheriffs say their focus will be on helping ICE deport immigrants who are here illegally and who have committed crimes. That's a small subset of the hundreds of thousands of immigrants without legal status who, at least for now, call Florida home. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from
a bottle and a glass, but in spite of everything,